Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we are in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We're broadcasting live from the Black River Beach Neighborhood Center, and we have a wonderful audience, full house. Thanks. Thanks so much to our audience with us, and thanks to you for listening in today. We're starting the show today by talking with you about the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife Fish Reserve, and a couple of people to talk with us about it. One, Sabrina Chandler, is the manager of the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife Fish Reserve. Sabrina, welcome to the show.
Morning, Larry. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you here, and it's great to have biologist Stephen Winter as well. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Larry.
Both work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and obviously know a whole lot about what's going on in the Upper Mississippi River Reserve. Questions for them, or maybe an experience to share. Have you visited parts of the reserve? What'd you like about it, or maybe not like about it? What do you want to know about the management of the refuge? It includes a lot of floodplains, for sure. Not only Wisconsin, for sure. We'll find that out. But you can join in at 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And for those in the audience, just raise your hand and Jill Nadeau will come around with a microphone and you can make your comment. Well, Sabrina, let's start with you. The Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Reserve, which is a mouthful to say, for sure. It was created over 100 years ago. Or no, it was created 100 years ago, was it not? Last June?
June 2024 was our 100th anniversary.
We talk about 240,000 acres, but give us a picture of the sort of where it spread out and along.
Yeah, so the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge covers four states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois. We pretty much cover from lower pool 4 down to pool 14, for those of you that are familiar with the navigation channels. But that's also bounded by the Chippewa River near Wabasha, Minnesota, down to around LeClaire, Iowa, just above the Quad Cities. So we're pretty much from the railroad tracks, bluff to bluff in that stretch. And like you said, almost a quarter of a million acres that we are able to protect and conserve.
Yeah, and this protection is pretty important. I would wonder if we hadn't had this, what it would look like.
Yeah, I think about that all the time, Larry, so I appreciate you bringing that up. I've had the good fortune to manage this refuge for over 10 years now, and came here on a 3-to-5-year plan and fell in love with it, and don't think I'll ever leave. So it's definitely one of those things that we're very fortunate to have, and if the refuge had not been established 100 years ago by some really forward-thinking folks, then we wouldn't have the beauty that we have here in the area and throughout the refuge. It would be levees and agricultural areas dominating the backwaters that we have available to us to recreate in.
And the floodplain itself, it's all right, we've had floods down the river and so forth, but I think this refuge really helps that situation.
It does. It protects the floodplain. It protects the wetlands that absorb those flood waters. And, you know, this refuge is also unique in that not only is it a nationally significant ecosystem, but it's also a nationally significant navigation system. And so we have that interflux of uses here, and with the navigation system, the pools basically do flood the floodplain in their entirety, but we are able to manage that accordingly and do restoration and absorb those big rain events that create those floods or the snow melt.
You know, this is a national reserve, and we have national reserves, we have national parks. How is a reserve different from a national park?
Yeah, National Wildlife Refuge is definitely very unique from the national parks. We are a system of lands that put wildlife first. You know, the National Park Service typically focuses on visitors and visitor opportunities, but by law, National Wildlife Refuges, we have to make sure that every use by the public, which we have many, especially on this refuge, are compatible with those uses that would impact our wildlife and habitat objectives.
I think it's such a cool story that how this got, how this whole reserve was created back in 1924. Will Dilg, I think was the guy's name, was, give us a little of that history.
Sure, yeah, it's an amazing story, and we're certainly proud to tell it, and we've had a lot of opportunities to do that this year in our celebrations. And Will Dilg was a fisherman from Chicago who liked to come over and vacation in the Winona area, and he was a pretty savvy businessman and had a lot of really well-connected opportunities with politicians and others, but basically, he had heard of some plans to create some levee and drainage districts along the river, particularly in the Winneshiek Bottoms, which is down in Iowa, just a little south of here, but also in the Winona area. And because he was concerned with that, what that would do to his ability to fish in the backwaters, he gathered up a bunch of his friends and the folks that he knew that had more political connections, and they went to Congress and petitioned for a law to create the refuge and protect those backwaters from those plans to levy and drain those areas.
I think he even founded the Isaac Walton League. Did
Absolutely,
he not?
Yep. He was in the efforts of, you know, working with his buddies, created the Isaac Walton League, which turned 100 last year. And there's a lot of active chapters that have continued to support the refuge, and they were the main proponents behind the big movement, as well as confederated women's groups.
Yeah, there was a very large women's group. I did want to have you mention that as well.
Yeah, so like I said, Will Dilg was very connected and started reaching out to folks, and the suffrage movement had just occurred, and so there were a lot of women with the newly opportunity to vote, and so they recognized that. There was a group, I think, of about 2 million women that started a letter-writing campaign to support the bill to create the refuge. And they recognized the value of nature for both the health of their families, but also, you know, their vacations were really starting to focus around camping opportunities, and that was the other reason that the refuge was established with a multi-use purpose.
And you're pretty much manager of the whole shebang.
Yeah, because it is such a large refuge, we have it broken up into management districts, and I oversee those four districts. We have offices in Winona, Minnesota, here in La Crosse, Wisconsin, down in Thompson, Illinois, and then our biggest district is the McGregor District, which right now is housed out of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, but we're building a new visitor facility in Harpers Ferry, Iowa.
Steve Winter, I want to turn to you as a biologist. What's your role here, basically?
So I support the biology activities of the different districts on the refuge, and so each district normally has its own wildlife biologist. We have one vacancy that we're hoping to fill, but they do the bulk of the on-the-river activities, collecting biological data, monitoring fish and wildlife populations, and a lot of what I do is help support them. But then I also work in a bigger five-state partnership that includes Missouri that is managing and learning about the Upper Mississippi River and the Illinois River. And one of the things that we're able to do now because of some recent Inflation Reduction Act funds that became available is we're able to get some researchers to do some really neat research projects on the river. So yesterday I spent the day with a faculty member and a new graduate student from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, looking at potential study sites that they will use when they start doing their research next summer and follow up the following summer.
Yeah.
And they're going to be looking at what we call secretive marsh birds. And so that's a group of birds that has that name, but generally they're thought, people think of that group containing the rails, and bitterns, pied-billed grebes, moorhen, things like that. And we know we have a lot of habitat for those species of birds. We just don't have a good sense of, well, how many do we have here how and what types of habitat are they specifically using. So hopefully we'll find out answers to those questions with this project.
Yeah. So somebody might say, not me, but somebody else might say, well, why would you do research like that? I mean, they're there. If you find them, how do you use those data when you have them?
So this refuge engages in a lot of big habitat projects that's funded by the Corps of Engineers, really large-scale projects. And so we've designed those projects to provide habitat for the species that each agency prioritizes and needs the help on the river. And so we need to know how to design those projects to benefit secretive marsh birds. So ideally, this project will say, well, they need a certain mix of emergent wetland and they need to be this distance from trees if they're going to use it as breeding habitat. So knowing those things will help us design those habitat projects.
Makes perfect sense. You mentioned the Army Corps of Engineers, and Sabrina, you have to work with the Army Corps of Engineers. What's the role of the Corps, and how do you work with that federal agency?
Yeah, well, we couldn't do our work without the Army Corps of Engineers, and we have a great relationship with them. We actually manage lands that they own in fee and manage those as part of the National Wildlife Refuge. Obviously, with the overlay of the navigation system with the refuge, we work with them on their operations to make sure that, you know, it's not impacting the refuge in a negative way. But the biggest way that we work with the Corps is what Steve alluded to with the Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program. That's authorized by Congress and funded by Congress. Right now, we get $55 million a year to the Corps of Engineers to do restoration on the Upper Mississippi River. That expands beyond this specific refuge, but about 75% of those projects occur on National Wildlife Refuges, and so that helps us meet our habitat protection and conservation and restoration objectives.
And here I was calling it a reserve all the time when it's really a refuge. And
it's interchangeable, yeah.
Okay. Our guest today is Sabrina Chandler, manager of the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Reserve, and Steve Winter. Steve's a biologist, works in this refuge. It's great to have both of them with us. Questions for them as we move along, I hope you'll join in. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And from our audience, our live audience here, feel free to raise your hands as well with a question. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us today here on WPR News. It's great to have two guests from the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Reserve with us today, Sabrina Chandler, who is the manager of the refuge, and Steve Winter, who is a biologist with the refuge as well and oversees a lot of the work that goes on there, the biological work. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org, or raise your hand if you're here in the audience and we'll take your comment or question. And we have somebody from the audience with a comment.
Hi, thank you for having your show in the Coulee region. We appreciate the chance to see it. My question is, some time ago there was talk about fish stairways traversing the dams to promote fish diversity. And I haven't heard anything about it in actually years. I wondered what the status or if there's been some progress in that direction.
Yeah, probably both people could take it. Sabrina, you want to start and then turn it over to Steve?
Yeah, I'll start. We call that fish passage, and there's a lot of work going on with fish passage with regard to researching what that means for some of our non-native fish that we have in this area, invasive carp. And so that has really slowed down some of the actual implementation of some of the fish passage projects that we'd like to see. But the Navigation and Ecosystem Sustainability Program, which was funded through the Inflation Reduction Act to the Corps, I know that's a lot of acronyms, but they actually got a pretty significant amount of money to do a fish passage project at Lockadam 22, which is down towards St. Louis. And so they are actually designing one of those now, a natural flowage around the lock and dam that would allow those fish to swim around the dam when it's closed. And they're doing a lot of pre and post monitoring and research of what that project will actually do to our fish populations in this area. Excuse me, as you know, there's the invasive carp, and so we're monitoring that and looking at some other abilities to still allow those native fish to move. But there's actually quite a bit of work going on, just not actual full-blown construction yet, because we want to be very cautious of what other implications that might create.
Yeah, Steve?
Yeah, so some of the native fishes that would probably benefit from those fish passage projects would be like sturgeon, lake sturgeon, mm-hmm. and some of the other sturgeons, pallid sturgeon, farther downstream on the system, as well as paddlefish. And these are fishes that we consider them migratory fishes. Their life cycle truly needs large stretches of rivers. And the lock and dam system that is in place is impeding them somewhat. Mm-hmm. And so they we probably don't have populations of those species that we might otherwise if they had unimpeded access to the entire stretch. Now, some other species that folks probably maybe heard about, like American eel. That's a species that's really restricted in its ability to move in this system. Mm. Likely before the lock and dam system, we would have had a fair number of American eels up in this far up the stretch. They breed, or they reproduce in the Sargasso Sea, which is part of the Atlantic Ocean. And then they move all the way up rivers like this. And it's rare now, relatively rare, to see an American eel this far up the Mississippi. Another species, I believe, is it a herring? Mm-hmm. A herring that cannot make it past, I think it's Dam 19. Mm-hmm. There's a species of freshwater mussel whereby the herring is its only host species that can help that mussel complete its life cycle. Mm-hmm. So above Dam 19, without those herring, that's an endangered species of mussel now, because it does not have its single fish host species.
Yeah, for those of the, that aren't aware, Lock and Dam 19 is a hydropower dam. It's the only hydropower dam that we have in this stretch of the river. So that is a pretty significant barrier to a lot of the fishes.
And just for location, where?
Keokuk, Iowa.
Keokuk, Iowa. Okay. You know, as you were talking about these different species, do we have a handle on how many species exist in this refuge?
For the fish, we do. Unfortunately, I can't remember the number. But this Upper Mississippi River system, with this well-developed, well-established partnership of the five different state agencies and at least three different federal agencies working together, part of that includes quite a bit of data collection, especially through an effort we call the Long-Term Resource Monitoring Element of the Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program. And so there are a number of locations along this Upper Mississippi River, including Pool 8, which is just downstream from us right here, where they annually monitor fish populations. And so they have a very good handle on what we call the status and trends of most of those fish species that they get in their monitoring data collection efforts every year. And so this is a pretty standout location in terms of biological and ecological knowledge about the resources that are here because of that annual monitoring that's done.
You know, it's a pretty cool, I mean, right where we're sitting is a pretty cool area. For those who aren't here, everybody's right now looking out on the Black River, and what's all behind us here,
yeah,
Sabrina?
Larry, so you mentioned the Black River, and the Black River is a tributary here in the La Crosse area that feeds into the Mississippi and creates the area called French Island, which is where the La Crosse Airport is. So if you've flown in and out of there or have visited the area, you may be familiar with that. So on the other side of French Island and at the confluence of the Black and the Mississippi, we do have National Wildlife Refuge lands that are available for public recreation and hunting and fishing and those types of activities. So we're very fortunate in this area to have a lot of public land, and definitely this is one of the nicest spots with the perfect view of the river here, with the Black River coming in.
And what we can't see on the other side of French Island is Lake Unalaska.
That's right, yep. Also known as Pool 7. That's one of our premier spots for our migration of our waterfowl species in the fall, and a big spot for a lot of fishing opportunities. So it just creates a phenomenal opportunity for recreation in this area. We're really fortunate for that.
I wish I had my rod and reel with me.
It's a good opportunity, good time of year, perfect weather. It's a shame we're sitting inside.
Yeah, and I can remember a very wonderful time watching wildlife in October up here with a bunch of Wisconsin Public Radio listeners, and it was really the volume. How many thousand geese, ducks of every type come in here, Steve?
So we probably have, at one point or another during the fall and spring migrations, every species of duck and goose and swan that you could reasonably expect to be in the Mississippi Flyway. And I don't have numbers for all those species, but two of our showcase species on this refuge are canvasbacks, that's a species of diving duck, and tundra swans. And this location, this refuge particularly, is one of the most important locations during the fall and spring migrations for both of those species, particularly the tundra swan. And we have data that we've collected in terms of surveying both those species, but that data can't be used to actually come up with an estimate of the total numbers. But we know from that data that a good year for swans, we probably have anywhere from 50 to 100,000 tundra swans on the refuge during a good fall migration year. With canvasbacks, a good fall migration year across the whole refuge, we probably have more than 100,000 canvasbacks. And it could actually be maybe close to 200,000. And there's few places in the country where you can see the numbers of those two species like you see them here.
I have about 50 or so decoys and wood carvings. And my favorite, one of my absolute favorites, is a canvasback that kind of a well-known guy put the carved. And that's beautiful to see, but they're even more beautiful to see in real life, for sure.
They are, and part of what I like to do when I watch them is just watch their behavior, and their behavior is really neat. The canvasbacks, they like to stay out in the vast open riverscapes, the big open pool portions, and they dive for their food, but they are just so supremely adapted out there. You can see when there's whitecaps out there, you'd think those ducks are just going to get seasick, but for the canvasbacks, they just handle it in stride. That's the world they live in. And then the swans, for those folks that have been out to see the tundra swans, one of the fascinating things is you think about, boy, they argue a lot with each other. And what they're doing is their individual family units are defending little temporary feeding locations. And so you'll see a family feeding, and another family will come up and try to push them off of that location, and the first family might try to push them back. And it ties into their biology. What that really is for is the parents are trying to ensure that their cygnets can feed uninterrupted and as much as possible, because the cygnets are still growing while they're migrating in the fall. And so those cygnets start their migration up in the tundra areas of Alaska and Canada. And when they get here, they're still growing. And then they have to get to the East Coast to spend the winter. And so through the fall migration and the winter, the parents are actually trying to make sure they get enough food to continue to grow and also to build up fat reserves to make the rest of their fall migration.
That is really cool. So they're traveling more than 1,000 miles, probably.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yep. It's long. So think of the northwestmost point of Alaska. Some of those are going to the East Coast, particularly the Chesapeake Bay region, particularly North Carolina. Yeah.
One of my former PhD students was in charge of the North Slope of Alaska after he finished his PhD and went back to the Alaska DNR. And so I have some experience and plenty of stories from John about that particular area. Sabrina, were you going to add something there on the wildlife side of things? We have a question from the audience. Let's go there.
Hi. Yes. Jeff from Berry Mills. I was wondering how the service is. Are you satisfied with the project that was done on Pool 7 across from in the Stoddard area, Stoddard, Genoa, Brownsville area? Is everybody happy with how that project turned out?
Sabrina, yeah, maybe describe what the project was, Sabrina, and then talk about it.
Yeah, I assume you're talking about a project that created some overwintering habitat, fishery opportunities there in Stoddard. It's been a while since that project was constructed, but we do performance evaluation reports, and that project does seem to be functioning the way that it was intended. And, you know, we do some periodic evaluations on those projects. All of our habitat rehabilitation and enhancement projects go through a periodic evaluation. And so we're always kind of looking and making sure that they're still performing. A lot of our projects that were created early on in that program have kind of gotten to the point to where the changing system has made them not as beneficial as we had hoped, and so we're working on right now trying to make a determination on where there's room for improvement, and we're also going through an effort to identify new project needs in the area and trying to prepare those to get on the list for funding.
Mm. One thing I can add is on my own time with vacation, I was one time fishing on the Wisconsin River up at the Dells.
Yeah.
And the person I was fishing with, he was saying he liked to go to the Stoddard Bay Area for panfish. Yeah. So he was willing to travel a decent amount to get to that fishing spot.
Panfish, bluegills?
Yeah, yeah. Bluegills, crappie, perch, yeah.
The whole
and largemouth bass, yeah.
All taste good.
They do.
we have another question from the audience.
Hi. My wife and I are lucky enough to live really close to the Mississippi River. In fact, we live on French Island. And we get a chance to canoe and kayak in Pool 7 and Pool 8, all close by. And we've been lucky enough to see beaver, muskrats, river otters. And I'm curious about the health of those animals and similar mammals in the whole region. Is it healthy? What are the threats? That's my question. Thank you.
All right.
So my take on the Mississippi River is that beavers just continue to increase in abundance. And that's what I see when I've been out there in the past 13 years, and that's what pretty much everybody I work with says. And that's what the trappers are saying as well. Beyond the upper Mississippi River, I'm not a person to ask about in the larger region. Otters, it's a similar story. The states reintroduced otters in a lot of areas decades ago, and then they allowed trapping after they were comfortable with the otter populations, and they've been steadily increasing the amount of otters that a trapper can take in their states. And we feel we're seeing more otters on the refuge alongside that other evidence that they're increasing. Muskrats are kind of a different story. This refuge in maybe the 50s used to have a whole lot of emergent wetlands, and that was kind of a response to the new, you know, somewhat newly put in lock and dam system. And people talk about one area called Weaver Bottoms up in Pool 5A, where they said there used to be so many muskrats out there, you could hop from one muskrat hut to the other and go all the way across Weaver Bottoms. And the muskrat population seems to have been declining. And I think the best explanation is that the river hydrology has been changing. And so a really important period of their life cycle is when they are having their kits or their pups in their lodges, and then we get a flood, and it floods them all out. And so we haven't seen nearly as many muskrat huts as people did in the past. Maybe like 4 to 5 years ago, I was seeing I and other people were seeing an increase, but then this year I think was pretty bad for them. I'm not seeing muskrats. And because we had a summer of high flows this summer, and that would have been exactly the wrong time for muskrats in their reproductive cycle.
Hmm.
Sabrina, you were going to add something there?
Yeah, I think just in general, you know, we do have a lot of engagement with our fur bearers. That's kind of the group category that we would lump all of those critters into. And we do have a trapping program on the refuge, but it is heavily monitored and working with the states and making sure that we're managing those populations, because there can be a point to where they become a problem. And just kind of keeping those populations in check. But I think Steve hit it on the mark. You know, the hydrology of the river is definitely changing with climate change and just these big inundations of water and unusual timings of floods. Those of you that are from this area know that we had a really weird summer flood. It stayed forever, and it changed the entire dynamic of the river as a result. So definitely a lot of external factors that are influencing what we're seeing on the refuge.
So what would be the reason for the uptick in beaver and maybe otter?
Both of them are responding from a really excessive harvest even a century ago. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, it's kind of a slow response. Okay. But they both are kind of responding from that long-term effect from decades ago. And you know, as state agencies were formed and developed, they were better able to manage, you know, the harvest and better able to manage the populations, allowing those species to increase. And like I said, with the otter, there's in various areas, there's been a lot of reintroduction of otters into the areas that they were extirpated from.
They're fun to see, that's for sure. A lot of fun to see. We have another question from the audience.
I'm curious about how the floods have caused so many dead trees up and down the river in this region. What's going to happen when those trunks start falling, as they will?
Yeah.
So we think of two really bad years that led to all the dead trees we're seeing now. 2018 was a year of extended high flows, and so the trees, basically their feet were in the water. Their roots were inundated. In 2018, some trees died, but a lot of trees were stressed. And then in 2019 was just an off the charts flood year. Where I'm at in Winona, the way I remember it is that as soon as when the ice went out, we were in flood stage, and we stayed in various levels of flooding until what I remember, like maybe a couple week period in August, and then it flooded again. And so the trees just did not have a chance to get their roots out of saturated soils. And sure enough, 2020 and on, we've seen some extensive areas of tree mortality. What will happen with all, I mean, that wood's going to fall down in a lot of ways that will, so while it's standing, it's going to provide habitat for some stuff. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine woodpeckers. Woodpeckers, and then all the secondary cavity nesters that will use the woodpecker cavities. But when it falls in the water, there's going to be quite a few aquatic organisms that will capitalize on that. And there's actually some of our colleagues in the USGS Upper Midwest Environmental Science Center, which is right over here behind us on French Island, funded through that UMRR long-term resource monitoring element, that are studying dead wood in the river, its origin, its transport, its fate. What kind of habitat is it providing, and where is it? How is it distributed across the river? And so they're really able to capitalize on the fact that we have a whole lot of new dead wood now. Yeah.
Insects as well. I mean, there's all kinds of creatures use those. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'll follow up on that. Generally, us river resource managers would have preferred for almost all those trees to stay alive.
Yeah, yeah. Sabrina?
Yeah, we have a lot of opportunity as a result of working with the Corps of Engineers and their Upper Mississippi River Restoration Program, and as Steve mentioned, the long-term resource monitoring that's funded by the Corps to USGS and the states to restore some of those areas. So as we lose those forests, all the dead trees that you see, we actually have a number of projects right now in the works to do restoration of those areas, and some of our habitat rehabilitation projects, one in the Reno Bottoms, just across the river here on the Minnesota side, where we're actually going in, and I think about 1,600 acres of what we call floodplain forest restoration, and to address those external factors I was talking about, climate change, increased inundation of the river, sustained high water levels. We're actually doing some dredging to provide fishery aquatic diversity and some habitat there, using that material to elevate the uplands or the higher ground to support those floodplain forests with this new normal of higher water. So there's a lot of tremendous science going on that's supporting that restoration, but a lot of also tremendous opportunity to do some significant forest restoration projects within the refuge.
Yeah, I mean, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, with all that water, there's got to be sedimentation going on. Just comment on that?
Yeah, that's and there's a whole lot of the public that is aware of that. A lot of the backwater areas that people remember fishing when they were a child or growing up are just, you know, very, very shallow now, and they don't support the fish populations that they used to. And so, again, those large-scale habitat restoration projects funded by the Corps of Engineers, they typically include a component where we dredge backwater areas so that they're deeper and will support the fish populations that they used to support. But it is a difficult challenge in terms of the river itself has so much sediment input that it will be a continuous task to address that issue with our habitat restoration efforts.
Yeah, thousands and thousands of tons every week.
Yes.
Pretty much every week. Sabrina Chandler and Stephen Winter are guests today. Steve, a biologist. Sabrina is manager of the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge. Questions for them, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for being with us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here as we talk about the Upper Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge with our two guests from who have big jobs with the refuge. Sabrina's the manager. Steve Winter is a biologist. They both work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as that's where they're housed. Again, questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org, and we'll take some questions, a couple of questions from the audience coming up here. Let's go to our first one.
Hello. I think it's very impressive to hear about all the work that you as scientists and managers and government agencies and legislators are doing to create this wonderful resource. My first question is, who are some of the regular folks and groups that help support what you do? And second, how likely is it that this kind of a refuge could be replicated other places on the river?
Sabrina?
Yeah, that's a great question, and gives me a little bit of an opportunity to brag on the people that help us make the ends meet. We are very fortunate on this refuge in particular to have what we call friends groups, so nonprofit organizations that are in agreement and have a partnership, official partnership with us to support us in a lot of ways, volunteer work, events, helping us staff the front desk, supporting individual projects and things. And so here in La Crosse, we have the Friends of the Refuge Pool 7 and 8. They call it 4, 7, and 8. And they are a tremendous asset for us and partner. And each of our districts on the refuge have friends group. In the Winona area, we have the Friends of the Refuge Headwaters. Down in McGregor, we have the Friends of Pool 9. And then down in our Savannah district, we have the Stewards of the Upper Mississippi. And so we are able to work with them. They're able to do certain things that maybe we as government employees and government agencies are limited by. And so They're tremendous assets and partners, and we really couldn't do it without them. So that's a big one. There's a lot of nonprofits and other organizations that work with us. We work very closely here in this area with the Lake Onalaska Management District and the Bryce Perry Conservation Association, and I could go on and list them all day, but really that is kind of how we work. We are a very minimally funded agency, and we depend on those partners to help us get our work done. So thank you for the opportunity to bring that up.
Yeah, and we had an email from Bev, who's listening in the state of Colorado, and she emailed remembering having a volunteer job at the refuge in Onalaska and called it the ultimate experience in her career so far.
That's awesome.
So
thanks, Bev. We appreciate your volunteering.
emailing from Colorado.
That's awesome. To the other question about establishing other refuges, there are opportunities to establish new refuges. The beauty of being part of the National Wildlife Refuge System, which now has 572 National Wildlife Refuges throughout the country, including in the Pacific and the lower 48, Alaska, Hawaii, we cover it all. So there is a process to go through to establish a new National Wildlife Refuge. It requires a lot of different moving parts. But what in this area, if you're talking specifically in this area, then what opportunities we have maybe to expand an existing refuge is a little easier, doesn't take as much effort. But we've got some other National Wildlife Refuges in this immediate area, which makes us even more fortunate to be here. The Trempealeau National Wildlife Refuge, and then the Driftless Area National Wildlife Refuge, mm-hmm. which is a pretty unique area that was established for two endangered species. The monk's hood is a plant, and then the a snail. So, pretty minor species that have a huge impact. They're really cool. They work in talisodrific slopes, and Steve could probably tell you more about that. But lots of National Wildlife Refuge opportunities here in the immediate area.
Yeah, really cool. Steve, do you want to comment?
You bet. So those are the northern monk's hood and the Iowa Pleistocene snail are what we call Pleistocene relics. So we know that we consider this the Driftless region, and what that means is it's a region that was not glaciated during the last glaciation period. There was previous glaciation periods where we did have ice here, but when the climate changed slowly and those glaciers receded, the species that were able to survive in very cold environments that you might think of, that existed here maybe 20,000, 30,000 years ago, most of them moved north. They, their ranges shifted north to stay in those cool, moist climates that you have to go to Canada now to find them. We have these algific talus slopes where, because of the karst topography, karst geology, where water flowing through the bedrock erodes the bedrock, and so we know that we have all these spring-fed streams, which is water flowing in the bedrock through the bluffs and then coming out into these nice cold water trout streams. That results in some areas where we have these cold air vents coming out the side of bluffs. Mm. And so those areas maintain a much cooler temperature during the heat of the summer. And those two species that you'd normally need to go north to find species like them are able to persist here in the Holocene when they used to be widespread across this region during the Pleistocene. And so we call them Pleistocene relics.
Ah, but it's really cool.
It's an extremely limited habitat, and that's why they're endangered.
That's really cool. Let's take another question from the audience.
Hi, thanks for a good show today. I was curious about the secretive marsh birds and how you study them, what data you collect, and how you go about it.
So they're called secretive marsh birds because they are secretive. They do not want anybody to see them. So it's rare to see them when we go bird watching for a lot of them. They do a really good job of staying hidden. One thing that they are suckers for is if you play their call, they'll call back. And so the classic survey method we call the call playback survey. So you go out with an audio device and play the call, and you record which species call back. and how many calls they might make when they call back. And you maybe can try to determine how many individuals based on, like, I got a call in front of me, I got a call to the left of me, so there's two of them. So that's one way we survey. This new project will also use just passive acoustic recording devices. They'll just put out these recording devices in various locations and just record 24/7 how many of those calls that are captured with those devices, and then they'll go out and pull the memory cards out, take it back to the lab, and process that data with software to get a sense of the activity level and the species.
Sort of like a camera, a trail camera in a way, except
exactly. Yep, yeah. That's a very good analogy.
Yeah, Sabrina, you were going to add something, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of value in technology, you know, it kind of give or take, obviously, with today's world, but the technology really has increased. You know, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, I was working on a master's project where we were trying to catch rails. Steve and I were talking about that this morning, and we had to give up because we couldn't. And so the technology is advanced now to where we can actually not have to put the hands on the birds and go through that effort and still identify the population. So lots of opportunities to use technology, and that helps us with our efficiency of our work.
Jerry was wondering, are there any new undesirable fish in the area?
I don't know about any new ones other than the various species of Asian carp that have been steadily pushing their way upstream. And so silver carp, grass carp, black carp are the three that come to mind, particularly the silver carp. Those are the jumpers that people are familiar with. But there are some relatively new invasive plants that have shown up recently. One, flowering rush was very sparse on the Upper Mississippi River prior to 2020. And we had those 2019 extreme flood years, and we suspect it's related to that, but in 2020, that species was all over the place in some of these pools, and it steadily increased in abundance and coverage. Another new one that showed up a couple years ago in Pool 8 was a brittle naiad. And there's other places in Wisconsin where people have discovered that. And we had our first confirmation, I think, in 2022, if I remember right.
I was thinking about this vast area, and I know I saw a news report from the National Wildlife Refuge system lost a lot of people. I mean, over the 800 staff or something, I think, since 2011. That's got to put a huge, and due to budget cuts primarily, so that's put a huge pressure on you, Sabrina, and Steve, and everybody else.
Yeah, it has. In the 10 years that I've managed the Upper Miss Refuge, we were around 52 staff when I started this job, and we're down to 28 permanent staff now. So we definitely are seeing some impacts of budget cuts. But like I said, we're able to, you know, benefit from our strong partners and our friends groups, and our volunteers are tremendously valuable. We get a significant number of volunteer hours a year with folks that are just passionate about working on the refuge and helping us out. And then, you know, working with our state partners and other federal partners, and, you know, it takes a village.
Yeah, and one way, even if you're not directly connected with one of those organizations, one way that anybody can help is to buy a duck stamp, for one thing. It's pretty inexpensive, and I know that 98% of the money goes directly into habitat restoration and development.
It does, yeah. The duck stamp dollars, anytime you buy a duck stamp, whether you're a duck hunter or just a stamp collector, that money does go into a fund that both supports land acquisition and habitat restoration projects across the country. So that is definitely one way that you can have a direct impact on conservation.
Well, I'll tell you what, the time flew. Thank you both so much for being with us today. I learned a lot. I think everybody else did as well. So thank you both, Steve and Sabrina. Great to have them with us today. Sabrina Chandler, of course, is the manager of the refuge, and Stephen Winter is a biologist. Both work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Coming up, we're going to be taking a look at outdoor opportunities in the La Crosse area. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we are broadcasting from the Black River Beach Neighborhood Center in La Crosse today with a wonderful audience. And we are really pleased to be able to talk about La Crosse and the La Crosse area. We took a look at the Upper Mississippi Reserve to begin the show, but now we're going to zero in on what's going on by way of hiking or biking or paddling in the area. And believe me, there's quite a lot going on, and a couple of guests to talk with us about it. One, Sammy Meyer, is Outdoor Recreation Coordinator for the City of La Crosse. Sammy, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to be here, have you here. Jed Olson is Executive Director of the Outdoor Recreation Alliance, and that is also based in La Crosse. And Jed, thank you for joining in.
Thank you. Thanks for bringing your familiar voice to the area.
Well, I tell you what. Yeah, somebody heard me talking last night, as a matter of fact, here, and said, oh, I know that voice. You can give us a call with your own questions or comments. Or have you experienced the La Crosse area? Have you biked or paddled or hiked in the area? We'd love to hear your comments. Certainly, the number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. And we have our live audience, a bunch of fit-looking people, if you ask me, and I'm thinking they're taking advantage of the opportunities here as well, and I know they'll join in as well. And raise your hand if you have a question or a comment. We'd love to have you do that here in the audience. Sammy, let's start with you. How'd you land in this job?
Sure, yeah, great question. I'm actually from southern Minnesota, so I'm a bit of a transplant, not very far into Wisconsin, but I made it across the river. I started in southern Minnesota in an agricultural interpretation role at a facility there. Shortly after, moved to work for Onalaska Parks and Recreation in more of their rec programming side of things and admin work. And then a role opened up here in La Crosse for outdoor recreation, and that is 100% where my heart lies. So yeah. I was really eager to get involved with that and take on that role.
Well, who wouldn't want to be involved? I mean, this is just such a facility. We talked a little about the facility, but this Black River Beach Neighborhood Center is pretty darn cool, if you ask me.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. There's a lot of opportunity here between programs and activities that take place, the river right behind us, the beach access here, the opportunity to rent the space for private uses as well as an option. Right here, yeah, we have quite a bit of opportunity on this location.
And Jed Olson, we must be close to some of the trails for biking and...
Yeah, absolutely. Those of you who are just listening, you don't get to see the view that Larry talked about, but we've got the river behind us. And one of the cool things about La Crosse is it's about 2 miles wide, which means that you're never more than 2 miles from the river and you're never more than 2 miles from the bluffs. So everybody here has wonderful access to really tremendous recreational opportunities.
I was thinking about bringing the lady in who was doing a painting a landscape right outside the window. Earlier, and I wanted to go out and see what yeah. It looks like. Talk about a beautiful setting for that sort of thing. It's really great. So the neighborhood center, Sammy, is that a good place to start? parking for to a good place to park, I should say?
Yeah, this is a location you can park in whatever you're looking to access, I guess. Like Jed said, the river is right here. So if you're looking for river access, whether that's with a kayak or a motorized vessel, there is a boat launch right here as well. So great opportunity there. There's an opportunity to hop on, sidewalk here, and then you're quickly in access to some of the marsh trails that can connect you throughout the city as well. And then getting up to the bluffs can also be an opportunity. But there's lots of access points throughout the city for those different recreational activities.
Yeah. Jed, you lead the Outdoor Recreation Alliance here in La Crosse. Talk about its mission and how it may have evolved over time.
Yeah. So the Outdoor Recreation Alliance, or a lot of people locally refer to us as ORA or ORA, it's one of the things that I call it a super science word. It's not overly technical. Outdoor, we go outside. Recreation, do fun stuff, and alliance. It's the people who band together to make things available. So it's a team of people who are trying to get others outside and do fun stuff. And we've been a nonprofit in the area for about almost 25 years now. We started as an organization called Human Powered Trails, but the same nonprofit transitioned to a broader mission and a broader vision and more impact. And our current mission is building happy, healthy, and resilient communities by providing sustainable and equitable access to outdoor recreation experiences. So pretty straightforward, pretty bulletproof, and what we're trying to do is really get people outside.
Well, and I want to get into the details of that as we move along today. Sammy, obviously La Crosse is known for its bluffs.
Yeah.
As well. Where do you recommend for hikers who want to go from there?
Yeah, I guess any of the bluff trails really are great options. One of the most commonly visited ones, I think, when people visit the area and they look for a viewpoint, they look for a quick accessible trail to head to, they go right up to the top, Grandad Bluff. Yeah. So that you can access a short drive up the side of the hill, the bluff. It is quite steep, so if you're looking to just get to the top, that's a quick access route as well. And then you do have a viewpoint from there if you're looking for a shorter stint. But then also just right on that same road are miles and miles of multi-use hiking as well. So whether you're hiking, biking, you can access both of those things right from that point. And that's a great place for someone that's new to the area or looking to get a quick overview of the landscape here to visit.
A new shot in the arm every time I go up there anyway. Talk about Ellen Hickson.
Ellen Hickson, yeah, I just actually familiarized myself a little bit more with her story. So Hickson Forest was previously a quarry. So there was a time period here in La Crosse where fires had swept through and they were looking for an alternative way to build some structures here to kind of prevent that. And so they found the rock, the limestone up there as a good source to prevent fires in our area. And so there's actually some buildings here, some historic structures that still have that material making up the interior exterior foundation of their building. And so some of the community members saw this happening and saw the landscape here being altered and effectively taken away. And so there was a plan that came into place to purchase this. And so Ellen Hickson actually was one of the biggest contributors to purchasing that land. And I think it was somewhere around $15,000 at that time that she contributed to make that purchase and turn that area into kind of a conservation, if you will, like conserve that area for recreational use, conserve the skyline of La Crosse that so many people had become used to, and keep it from being turned into foundations of homes.
Yeah, she raised $15,000, but $12,000 came out of her own pocket, and $12,000 in 1909 dollars. I mean, $12,000 is a lot for me right now, let alone 1909. Without that money, we may not have.
Yeah, our landscape, our skyline may look vastly different without that contribution from over 100 years ago.
Yeah. Thank you, Ellen. And we have a question from the audience. Let's go there. Hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make some comments about the beauty and the accessible recreation. It's just unbounded here. I work at the rest center on I-90 going east, and people that travel through here are just amazed. They come from all over the world. I mean, I'm not talking United States. I'm talking India, Pakistan, China, Australia, and they just can't believe how beautiful it is here. They had no idea. And then when I tell them about where to go kayaking, where to rent a kayak, they can't believe that they have access to all this. And some of them say, well, we are staying because we have discovered things that we never thought were here. So we have a gem.
Wow, a great comment. Thoughts on that? Jeb, turn to you first.
Yeah, well, you just told my story. I went to school in central Minnesota, and I had friends from school who were La Crosse residents, and they said, you got to come to La Crosse. You'd love it. You'd love everything that's here. And I said, yeah, okay, whatever. Finally, they convinced me about 25 years ago, and I drove down 94 from St. Cloud area to the Twin Cities, then down 52 to Rochester. Again, nothing interesting the entire way. Come across I-90, and there's a couple of spots where you see a glimpse of, like, some rocks, and you're like, what was that? And then a lot of corn. It was mid-July. And then I hit the drop at Nodine, and I tell this story 25 years later, and without fail, I get goosebumps because that was where I realized I was entering a special place, and I stayed. I mean, that's my story. It's pretty to the point. We came here, we explored, we left. Ultimately, 18 years ago, we moved back from California to the Midwest, and we knew that if we were going to live in the Midwest, it had to be a place with access to water and hills, elevation, great culture, and this is exactly that special place.
Very well said. We've got Pete in La Crosse who has a question for us. Pete, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hey, good morning, Larry and guests. I want to talk about the Bud Hedrickson Bicycle Bridge over the Northside Railroad tracks. It's a wonderful addition to the bicycle trails. And I know there was a considerable amount of effort over many years required between various the railroad companies underneath the bridge, the various government agencies. But they made it happen, and that bridge makes for safe crossing over those railroad tracks. So it's great that thing that's been accomplished. My question is, what's going to be involved in doing that in other places in La Crosse? And in particular, I think walkover bridges would be very useful in the university area, but I know it's a big accomplishment. So tell us a little bit about how you accomplished what was done to build that bridge and what's going to be needed to build more bridges like that.
Yeah, I think this is probably a good spot for someone who works for the city to jump in. As far as that specific bridge, I know that is really a critical connection point. I am a recreation person myself, between hiking in the bluffs to running throughout the community. I live up in Onalaska, and so that really makes it accessible to run from Onalaska to La Crosse in a safe way, or bike in a safe way, walk in a safe way, and pass over that railroad corridor. So that construction project was before my time with the city of La Crosse, but I know there were a lot of players involved in that, and anytime we work with the railroad, that is also a big feat in itself, because those facilities and infrastructure is critical for our way of life also. So respecting that and respecting the need to transport yourself safely is something that is really important to the city, I believe. And then as far as expanding that, I think there are various methods that were happening right now, whether it's public knowledge or not, or I shouldn't say public knowledge, most of it is already out there publicly, or whether it's common knowledge or not is more fitting, I think. The city of La Crosse just spent a few years working on the Forward La Crosse Plan, which is a comprehensive bicycle plan, and I don't think that necessarily just is for bicyclists, but yeah, safe transportation and use in the city of La Crosse. And so that plan was developed, and I think looking at that and looking at the critical pieces that need to fall into place throughout, you know, a prioritized process is something that is being looked at, and it is in the forefront of planning department, engineering department, parks department, thinking about how we can connect users, community members, visitors throughout the city in a way that they can use their feet or their bicycle or those kind of methods.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to talk some more. I want to talk some more about that bicycle system because I think it's really fascinating story, and we'll get to that. But right now, Sammy Meyer, you just heard talk, is the outdoor recreation coordinator for the city of La Crosse. Jed Olson, executive director of Outdoor Recreation Alliance, based in La Crosse. And you can join in, too, with questions or comments. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@wpr.org, or if you're in our live audience, just raise your hand and Jill will be there with a microphone. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We're taking a look at outdoor recreation opportunities in and around the city of La Crosse with Sammy Myers, who is the outdoor recreation coordinator for the city, and Jed Olson, who is executive director for the Outdoor Recreation Alliance, based in La Crosse as well. We have some emails, and we have a live caller, or a live person, I should say, in the audience.
I am alive, and I enjoy all the outdoor opportunities in the La Crosse area. Myself, I understand the economic impact outdoor recreational opportunities have on a city, but could you speak to that a little bit? I know sometimes communities are reluctant in tight budgets to put money into recreational opportunities in cities, but in my opinion, it comes back tenfold.
Yeah, that's a very. I wanted to talk with you about that as well. So thanks for bringing that up. That economic impact study. There was one done 2018, I think.
There's a number of economic impact studies that happen, and then there's a lot of the anecdotal evidence that we can, you know, that we can just see as experience. But typically, when we talk about, you know, the cost benefit ratio or return on investment, we see really big returns on outdoor access. Partly because the asset's already here, right? The river's already here. The bluff is already here. I ran the numbers on Grandin Bluff. If we needed to build that out of clean fill. It's a triangle and it's a ridge, right? So we can calc that out. It's $200 million. And so any city who wants to build a Grandad Bluff is pretty expensive. We've got like eight of them in a row, right, in our city. And so we don't have to build the bluff here. We just have to polish it and put those little access improvements in. So, Larry, I love that you've been using this phrase or this keyword opportunity. And there's a difference between opportunity and access. And so there's a lot of access in our area. You heard about the thousands and thousands of acres of public land in the refuge. And by making boat landings and maps and little things that help people lower the barrier to get out, those are pretty low cost comparatively to get out. So one of the things that I like to measure and compare against is curb and gutter, right? Curb and gutter is not very sexy when it comes to attracting tourists to your town. It costs $25, $35 a linear foot to just put that curb in along a street. To build a trail, a single track trail in the woods is about $7. To build a wide trail like this Bud Hendrickson Trail is maybe $15 to $20. It's comparable, and it just makes these great improvements. Now, to build a bridge over a railroad operation, that price goes up a bit. But there's a lot of research out there that shows that there's great economic impact from the direct action. There's people selling binoculars and selling hiking boots and stuff like that. That's one area of economic impact. But the one that I really like to highlight is the community identity. And so as we've heard, this is a very special place. When you say La Crosse or the Driftless or the Coulee region, the Blufflands, everybody pictures this wonderful place, and that builds community between you and your neighbor, you and the person who's working next to you, even if you don't work in an outdoor setting, right? You don't have to be a tour guide to really have that comparison. And right now, businesses are looking for people, and people follow that sense of place. And then the money follows the people. And so it's very difficult to measure the true impact of that. But I really like your opinion of it matters and it's significant.
Yeah, very well said. And Sammy, that economic impact study that the city did, it was really interesting to me. Talk some more about the dollars there.
Yeah, and again, that was prior to my time with the city, but I am familiar with it. And I know that was through our planning department did that study, and I know another study, right? But we did that study and some findings, I think it's the number, something around the likes of like $300 million. Mm-hmm. And that was a study kind of if we implement all of these things, right? Like all of these opportunities, all of these access points, different bikeways, different bike lanes, different modes of transportation. So it was really focused on bicyclist transportation, pedestrian transportation. But so that $300 million is broken down into, like Jed was saying, not just, you know, the sales of things, like economic impact through direct sales, but like health impacts, right? So when you're commuting to work and using your bicycle, you're also getting physical activity, which is, you know, improving your cardiovascular system and potentially decreasing the amount that you need to visit the doctor for certain things. And now that's very simple, like simple path, but health and safety regulation. So making these access points safer and off-road routes, keeping people away from moving vehicles. So health and safety, the simple economic sales of things, wellness impacts as well. All of those things kind of tally up in different ways to get to that top tier, $300 million. And it was somewhere, there was a range of numbers, but $300 million was the top number with potential impact.
Yeah, and part of it was based, if I'm not mistaken, on looking at other areas where this had been, other states and other places where this had already been done, and then we're able to draw from that information.
Right. We don't necessarily have to. Yeah, there's other communities that are doing this successfully and have implemented these measures, and we don't have to reinvent the wheel. We just have to make the wheel fit our area. And so I think looking at ways to do that is really important.
I'm from Madison. I live in Madison, and we have quite an extensive bicycle set of bicycle trails in Madison. So when I drove downtown to my hotel last night, it was nice to see the bike trail, the bike road street that is pretty wide. From my perspective, I thought, wow, this is great. What's all going on with the trails in the city and the surrounding area?
Yeah, so that specific... Were you going
to... No, go ahead.
Okay.
And then I'll go to Jed after.
Okay. That. So that specific route that I think you're referring to is rather new. I don't know exactly when it was open, but I believe it's either a little over a year or less than a year old. And so that, is really kind of the goal, is to increase safe and accessible routes for transportation, for recreation. And that really connects people to... an active part of our city, a place where they can leave economic impact, the restaurants, the stores, the different places to visit down there, places to work, commute to work. So I think that is kind of one of the first big projects in connectivity here in La Crosse. And so exemplifying that, this is a safe place for people to bike, safe place for people to get to work, to get to shops, to get to restaurants, to really live, a safe place to live. And that's kind of a blueprint for what it could look like and connectivity-wise throughout the city.
I know I was impressed too. I took a look at the maps, and it's a lot of careful planning is going into expanding the trail systems throughout the city, Jed.
Yeah. Yeah, our organization can't take a lot of credit for those wider trails that are, you know, kind of the surface area. But having been a longtime resident and a longtime advocate for these things, watching how they move forward, there is a lot of planning and work that goes into it. And being a little bit of a history buff, I love doing the research and looking back and hearing about those efforts. Sometimes it's a little depressing when you hear about the failed efforts over literally hundreds of years of trying to make these improvements. But Joseph Losey was a contemporary of Ellen Hickson, working towards preserving the bluffs and telling this story in our community. And going back to the late 1800s, he had this vision that people could go from the river through the marsh, up the bluff, and out to Grandad Bluff. And I would say that through many phases You know, every 30 years, kind of there's a spike in movement and you get a little bit more. But in 2020, we completed a trail system that took you out to Granddad Bluff. And so you could go pretty much off street from the Pearl Ice Cream Shop downtown. By the way, we're in Wisconsin, so you measure proximity by dairy and alcohol. So so I can either list the bars you go past or the ice cream shops you go past. But so you can go from right downtown, off street, under highways, under railroad tracks, up through these different pieces that over 125 years we've acquired for either access or public lands, and you can get up to the top of Granddad Bluff off the streets in a safe, reasonable way, and that's for the betterment of our entire community. It's the great equalizer. Whether or not you own a large farm that gives you that space to go wander on your own, if you live in an apartment here in town, you can still have access to, you know, all those great things. We've been able to you know, have a canoe kept in the backyard of an apartment in town here, and that's wonderful. It gives everybody these opportunities to bring the benefits that Sammy just mentioned, and it gets people out of their houses, crisscrossing through the community, and the sidewalks extend, and the front porches extend all the way through these natural spaces.
Have we got a question? Oh, we have a question from the audience, so let's go there.
All righty. I'm just kind of expanding out from the city of La Crosse a little bit. I know our area is surrounded by rail trails. You know, you can actually at this point start down at Reedsburg, Wisconsin, which is kind of down in Larry's area a little bit, mm-hmm. Reedsburg, go up through, join up the Elroy Sparta Trail, then grab the Great Rivers Trail and come into La Crosse. Now you're up about 75 miles, I would imagine. Keep going from Unalaska, you can go up to Trempealeau. And there's been discussions about being able to go across the river and join onto the Root River Trail and end up in Lanesboro.
Yep.
Has there been any more discussion around that? Or?
Yeah, I can share that there's been a renewed effort, right? And again, these have been, you talk about the Rails to Trails program, and we were the front end of that. That Elroy Sparta Trail, those were the earliest Rails to Trails programs in the country. It's been emulated all over. And we have a couple of gaps. If you were to draw that all out in a red marker, it looks like this big spider web with just a couple of small gaps. As you're talking about going north of Trempealeau even to get to Winona, we're just a couple of miles from connecting the Flyway Trail up there. The city right now is working on connecting the Wagon Wheel Trail, which would take you to the new wonderful pedestrian bridge in La Crescent. And then I think we're maybe 11 miles gap. It's not a lot. And so I ran some numbers a couple of years ago, and I think we've got about like 18 miles of trail connectors. That was about 4 or 5 years ago. And now some of those miles have been crunched down smaller and smaller to what I call, what we're looking for is that golden spike that connects the two, you know, the two systems end to end. And obviously those miles of trail that aren't built yet are the most expensive, or yeah, you run into other logistical problems. So that's why they aren't there. They're the harder ones to build. But this is a story I love to share, is to show how close we are to making those connections. And I do know the other side of the river, there's efforts to connect from Red Wing coming south as well. So there's all sorts of things in movement. And I can tell right now just by looking at the audience that you guys have a few things going for you. You all have some free time that you're able to, you know, come out and join us in the middle of the day. Most of you look like you're voting age. And so there's a lot of ways to get involved. I know Sabrina mentioned, you know, this great army that helps them make things happen out at the refuge. It's that same type of thing. Don't keep that to yourself. Don't talk about it just to your neighbor. Remind your elected officials that this is important. Remind business leaders that this is important. And those names, you know, like the Ellen Hicksons we talk about, they have this big vision. They took major action, as Larry pointed out. You know, she ponied up 3/4 of the funds needed to make this private-public partnership happen. So keep talking about it, keep taking action, and keep being, you know, the doers who help make these things possible.
We have an email from Nancy in Appleton. Nancy's understanding is that La Crosse was an early adopter of the Complete Streets program. and is interested in hearing both your comments on the importance of complete streets in that program. I think you've kind of been going on it a little bit, but expand.
Yeah, I am not as familiar with that program, but from what I gather, yeah, it's making safe passages and safe corridors for transportation in our city. And yeah, I kind of covered it from our end. I think it is really critical to have those pathways, those transportation corridors, where if people choose to, they have safe and accessible routes to get from place to place, and get from amenity to amenity, from places they need to buy groceries back home, et cetera. I think giving people that option is really something that needs to continue moving forward. So that's where I stand on it.
You know, and just to go along with what our audience member mentioned, I have an email from Frank who says La Crosse is one of his favorite biking areas in Wisconsin. He and his brother like to stay at a nice cottage north of La Crosse where they can access the Great River Trail, La Crosse River Trail, the Elroy Sparta Trail. A short drive away, of course, is the fantastic River Trail in Minnesota. Wonderful facilities, good local restaurants in La Crosse as well. Nice to hear that.
Yeah, maybe he could consider, getting a job here and moving here.
Jen, I understand you get, and I don't think you've talked about this, you recently... your organization, not you personally, but your organization recently purchased a former 300-acre farm?
Yeah, that's correct. I think, again, going back to this mindset of we have these wonderful, this wonderful place to call home for so many of us, and generations of people have enjoyed, you know, being able to be connected to the land here and call this place home and visit here and recreate here. And as we look to kind of make these further connections, expand the networks, provide more access to more people, there's a number of players in movement. Some of them are government agencies. Some of them are private entities like our nonprofit. And sometimes the right player at the right time is that private movement. And so there is an opportunity on the south side of La Crosse in the town of Shelby that really seemed like a wonderful fit. We explored a few different ways to pursue it, and ultimately, it inspired by some community leaders, we took the big step and we wrote a purchase offer. And we said, what if we wrote a purchase offer? Well, then somebody has to say yes or no, and then if they say no, it's an easy next step. And if they say yes, then what's next? Well, I guess we'd have to find some money. And then and then if people say yes, we think this is a good idea, then we have to find more money, and then we have to plan it, and then we have to develop it. So that's exactly what we're doing. We're calling it the Community Trail Farm. And the idea, and the, again, a super science word, right? It's for the community, and it's an old farm. And on farms, you plant one thing, you put inputs in, and you hope for a yield coming back. And we are building community through trail access. So we've purchased this 300-acre farm. It was an old dairy. It's the original site of the first ski hill in the area. There's a lot of history of transportation and movement and historical trade. It's along Pamel Creek, which is along trade routes that eventually turned into State Road. It's the first road the state built that came to La Crosse. There's this long history, economics meeting the landscape, the resources, and people's enjoyment. One of the things when we talk to people, they say, oh, when I was a kid, we used to run up and down the bluff all the time. And then I say, well, that's awesome. And whose land were you on? And they say, well, I don't know. Nobody cared 60 years ago. And now people really do care. And so it's really important to protect places, provide access, and develop that. So this is a space that we are protecting and then sharing back out to the community. So we're in process of planning, continuing fundraising. We hope that you've heard a little about it, and we know that you'll hear a lot more about it. And we're looking for partners to come in. I literally came from a meeting with the school district, with the superintendent, talking about how we can build partnerships there, how we can take, not to say anything negative about schools and kids, but captive audiences. these animals that are in captive and bring them out to this space. So we want to partner with as many entities as we can. We don't want to reinvent wheels. We want to take wheels that already exist and bring them out. So I could talk for hours and hours just about that one project, but it's about having the audacity to solve problems and take big strides. It's about inclusivity, making sure that we're doing this not just for myself, but for the entire community. I refer to it as the middle of the bell curve. There are people who will go outside in any weather and run 100 miles. They're fine. They don't need our help getting outside. It's the people who maybe forgot what it's like to be outside, or the people who only have 45 minutes before the dinner's got to be ready, or whatever that is. And we want to compete against Nintendo, nicotine, and Netflix. You know, those are easy buttons for people to get the responses, the dopamine and the oxytocin responses. We need to compete with that. So we need things that can happen in 22-minute segments and that are easy to access, that are safe, predictable, and that you really understand what can happen. And we are blessed with this wonderful topography here in La Crosse, which means if you go for a hike in Hickson Forest, you're probably going to be going straight up the bluff. By having in this parcel, we've got about 35 acres of tillable land that are the lower spaces that can allow you to meander, to stroll, to walk side by side and have a conversation instead of just huffing and puffing as you're climbing up the bluff and then trying to gain your footage for this beautiful view. So we've got 500 feet of elevation. We've got a class one trout stream. We've got old agricultural buildings. We've just got wonderful spaces out there that we're really excited to share with everybody.
Yeah, and it's no small project. You're looking at $6 million or
that's there. That's our capital campaign goal. It's a working goal right now. But yeah, it was... it's expensive to buy wonderful things, but we all do it. We all make that choice. I see a lot of people wearing a wonderful, very functional raincoat that might cost $100. Sometimes expensive things are really awesome, and we're making the effort to do a big growth opportunity for our organization and really hoping to have major impact on our community.
And Sammy, that's right next to, or located just outside the La Crosse city limits. So you got to be excited about this as well, as I'm sure the whole city is.
Yeah, I've had the opportunity to go out to the site and do some work out there to help Aura and get some of these first aspects just a little bit fleshed out. And it's really wonderful out there. The sight lines that are available are going to be... really awe-inspiring. I think people are going to have a great chance to go see yet another view from the La Crosse area. And it is in the town of Shelby. And I think that speaks to kind of the area's willingness to come together, like municipalities, town of Shelby, town of Onalaska, or city of Onalaska, town of Onalaska, town of Madary. Like, we all have access to these properties that are recreational opportunities, and there is an existing organization also that Jed and I both participate in called the Bluffland Coalition, and I think Jed would have maybe another chance to speak about the possibility of something called the Bluffland Traverse, and so that would really be a great another access to really running the span of the bluffs from north to south, south to north. And I think it's about a 50-ish mile stretch.
Yeah, you end up covering about 30 miles of linear distance with almost 60 miles of route. And so you can imagine it something like an Appalachian Trail or an Ice Age Trail where on day one, it's not fully done and complete, right? Right now we have a lot of the trail is a route that goes on city roads, township roads, along state highways, and then we tuck it into the bluffs any chance we get. So again, as Sammy mentioned, it's a coalition of municipalities and nonprofits that are working together towards this shared vision of a connected community, a community connected to nature and through nature. So right now, I think the trail measures out around 60 or 62 miles. And our vice president of our organization, Mike Borst, ran it in a day to kind of bring awareness to this identity of it. But it's a benchmark feature of our area that it goes from the Black River on the north end of our county all the way down to Goose Island, which is the very southern border of our county, and you start really out bodies of water at each end, and you're through the bluffs the whole way.
There you go. We'll talk some more about that with our guest, Jed Olson, Executive Director of the Outdoor Recreation Alliance, and Sammy Meyer, who is the Outdoor Recreation Coordinator, I believe, for the city of La Crosse. I think I've got that right. I'm Larry Mueller for WPIR News. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to be talking about home improvement, as we often do on Thursday, and we'll look at, for one thing, choosing new siding for your house. Then we'll consider the options and benefits of installing solar panels. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Right now, taking a look at the outdoor activities that are available in and around the city of La Crosse with Sammy Meyer and Jed Olson. Again, you can join in with your own experiences or questions. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Hickson Forest has come up pretty often. Can you talk a little more about the opportunities in Hickson Forest?
Yeah, we work really closely with Aura, and so I'm sure Jed will have more to say about this also, but opportunities really, they can start at the bottom, the top of the bluff. We've talked about access points. You might have to help me with the exact mileage of trails out there, but there's quite a number of trails that are either hike and bike, hike only. Really, there's a great pump track up at the top of Upper Hickson Forest as well, and Aura really spearheads a lot of those efforts to expand those trails, help us maintain those trails in the city. We had, I think, last year, the addition of something called a forest bathing route, and so that's a quieter exercise that you can do out in those trails as well. Wildlife viewing, bird watching, all kinds of opportunity in that area.
And even in the winter, I understand there's some cross-country skiing and snowshoe opportunities and so forth out there.
Yeah, yep, and Aura helps us with that. Maintaining our cross-country skiing trails, yeah, they do that as well for us. They're a great help. I know the Upper Mississippi Wildlife Refuge mentioned all of their partner organizations, and Aura is an exceptional partner to us. We couldn't do a lot of the things that we do and offer within the city as a municipality without the help of organizations like Aura, and they do a lot for us, including that.
Jed, you want to comment as well?
Yeah, I think that just like, you know, Sammy and I didn't come up here just to pat each other's backs, but it happens, right? We, as an organization, we've been around 25 years, and we own our first piece of property now. So that means that all the work that we've been doing for 25 years is through partner municipalities. And so the city of La Crosse, has needs, and our organization is a great place to fill those needs. There's a scientist named Roger Walsh who talks about therapeutic lifestyle changes or choices that that we all need above our Maslow's pyramid. But it's things like service, nutrition, healthy foods, time outside, building community, building relationships, and it actually is an opportunity that some people took a while to really acknowledge that they might actually like working on trails as much as they like hiking on trails. So we've got a group of really dedicated cross-country ski enthusiasts who also love grooming. It's hard work. It happens in the very early morning hours or late evening hours, and it's not usually warm. And they go outside and they make sure that there's groom surfaces that are available for both cross-country skiing, and then we have volunteers who do a lot of grooming for fat bike trails. And so it's making sure, again, that those trails are well prepared, and without a willing partner in the landowner and the manager, the city of La Crosse, we wouldn't have that space to give that opportunity for service back to so many of our volunteers.
That's great. And we have a question from the audience, so let's go there.
It's wonderful to hear about all these outdoor activities we can participate in, especially the biking and the hiking, the cross-country skiing. But I think it would be nice to talk about the fact that La Crosse actually has a water trail for kayakers and canoers as well, and not just the Mississippi or the Black River, but if you can give us some more information about the La Crosse River water trail.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with the water trail here in La Crosse. I know personally I've seen people out utilizing those spaces and utilizing whether that's a canoe, a kayak, a pedal kayak, fishing, recreational purposes. You can get a lot of different places just on the La Crosse River, and you can go up to Onalaska has a kayak launch at one of their parks, and then that can lead you into the La Crosse River, whether you're going northeast or coming south into La Crosse.
Lots of opportunity.
Yeah, extensive route there that you can take advantage of. You can access in Onalaska. There's a lesser known access point in Riverside Park, which is just south of here as well. And that can you can access the La Crosse River, Mississippi River, from that location as well.
One of the things that was talked about last hour is these really kind of crazy high water events that we've seen. And there are obviously there's a lot of negative impacts from that stuff, but one of the positives that comes out of that is adventure. All of a sudden, you can take a canoe or kayak or a paddleboard to places that really maybe nobody's been to in 50 years, right? Because it's normally very muddy and you couldn't drive a power boat there. And so at high water, it gives you this opportunity to just glide through these forests and in really special places. And then in the winter, that all freezes hard and you can go for a bike ride out across flat frozen ground that would otherwise be too muddy to get to, or you can ice skate through the backwaters or out in the marsh. And you know, Wisconsinites, I think, have this tradition of being, you know, a little over the top sometimes when it comes to doing a thing. So if you know somebody who ice fishes, they're probably pretty into it, and they'll probably tell you a lot about it. If they're a cross-country skier, they'll tell you how many times they did the Berkey and everything else, right? So it's really wonderful to see people taking advantage of these creative opportunities to go to both on the established water trails that are out there, but then when the conditions are right, you flip it on its head and you go create a water trail where there's normally land, or you, when the water's low, you get to go out and see places that haven't been exposed in a long time. So it's one of the things that I really love to watch people make their own and kind of go above and beyond and show off a little bit, but in a really humble Midwest way.
So what's your favorite thing to do outdoors, in the out of doors, Sammy?
Oh, man. I have a lot. And some days it's really hard to choose. It's like almost overwhelming. Like, do I want to go kayaking today? Do I want to go for a trail run today? Do I want to go play pickleball today? Do I want to go for a bike ride today? Like, the options really are so endless here in La Crosse. My favorite thing that I do probably most often, though, is hike. In our region, I have a dog at home, and so we really like to get out on the trails and see new things. Every time we go out, it's different as the seasons change here.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And what about you, Jen?
Well, that's an interesting question. And as Sammy was talking, I went through about 15 options, but I think my answer is fly. Now, unfortunately, I'm a human, so I have some limitations there. And so for me, it's swimming and biking. Biking gives you that you can coast, and it becomes magical. And my favorite time and place to bike is just through a quiet neighborhood in the dark. You know, at dusk in the evening. Because you move through your community, you see what's going on, and it's really kind of a really cool, and it doesn't take super expensive equipment, and it doesn't take, you know, an epic trip to the Boundary Waters or whatever. And then I really do love being in the water and being, you know, weightless and exploring. So,
well, it's been a pleasure talking with both of you. I really appreciate it, and there is lots to do in the outdoors in La Crosse and the La Crosse area. Sammy Meyer is the Outdoor Recreation Coordinator for the city. Jed Olson, Executive Director of the Very Active Outdoor Recreation Alliance based in La Crosse. It's great having them with us today. And I just want to, at the end, to take a minute to recognize Tom Blaine, who is our technical director. Tom and I, he retires next week. Uh, I don't know how many times we've been on the road together since he started back in 1990, but it's a lot of times. I'm remembering Lambeau Field and Bayfield and Door County and Paoli and all over the place. And he has done it. I asked Jill, how do you consider Tom? She says, well, I consider him as, let me see, considerate, thoughtful, kind, patient, inventive, and tenacious. And those all work. He's a great guy, and good luck in retirement, and thank you very much. And thanks to the rest of our staff, Tyler Ditter, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, Ezra Wall, our regional manager. Lots of people helped out today, and thank you.